So I'm here now with Miranda McPherson, who I know you guys have been listening to some of her audios here in the sanctuary for the last week, including her Buddha at the Gas Pump interview. Of course, I know some of you have not heard these interviews, and so for you, you're here to get to know Miranda. Miranda, why don't you just say hello, and we'll see if they can hear you okay.
Yeah, it's really lovely to be here with you, Regina, and look forward to a juicy dialogue.
Yeah, it should be wonderful. So I assume you all heard Miranda? Yes, perfect. Okay, good. So what I've asked Miranda to do is just start with a very, very brief introduction to herself, and I trust that she knows just how much detail to go into, but we're much more interested in her teachings than her history, but I know that some of you all want to get to know who she is. So Miranda, please take it away.
Well, I don't know where you'd like me to begin, but just in that all my life I have been kind of really sitting with the perennial spiritual question, which is, who are we really? You know, what is a true life? And I think this is a really important question, and that we can't really grapple with, you know, live a true, meaningful, fulfilling, authentic existence unless we really address that question, and not just conceptually, but really bite down on that question with our whole being. And so this is something that was happening for me when I was a young child, you know, growing up on the beaches of Australia. And for some reason, I seem to have pretty easy access to a lot of kind of vastness, supported by those expansive environments of endless sea and sky. And so, like many of us, I feel that I came in with a certain understanding of the non-conceptual way of things. And like most people I know, you know, there's the descending heaviness, really, of personality. And so I was no different. You know, I found myself sort of losing the access to, you know, this intuitive knowing of the depth of our being and the joy diminishing. And, you know, long story short, I had, you know, really a spiritual crisis that was labeled sort of clinical depression when I was a 13-year-old. And there were a bunch of things that constellated that experience, but I ended up spending close to 2 months in a psychiatric unit, an adult psychiatric unit, when I was 13. And sometimes it's when, you know, we're in such a kind of a dark place that there's an enforced surrender that happened. And so that was really my first conscious spiritual awakening into, you know, the boundless dimensions, which occurred in the dimension of boundless love, you know, I was 13. And it happened spontaneously through exhaustion and by grace, really, but I had a very deep experience then of that what I was, what everything and everyone was really this infinite boundless love. And that the purpose of life was to really dissolve the barriers to living this 100%. And so it put me on the spiritual path, and I voraciously read as a teenager many teachings, anything I could get my hand on. And that seemed to be mostly Eastern teachings, Ramakrishna, Vivekananda, teachings like Blavatsky, Ospensky, some of the early Gurdjieff work. And so I began to really study voraciously anything that was speaking to this that had come alive inside me and had really plugged me back into the mains of something that I kind of always knew but had lost. And so that really began my path of, you know, conscious study, practice, inquiry, exploration. And like I think all of us, you know, one thing led to another, and so my path evolved, and I studied what I needed to at different junctures on the journey. And so this included psychological in-depth study and experiential inner work with breath work, and included studying with a Zen master, studying Zen meditation. It included studying, you know, world mystical traditions and scriptures, and I trained and was ordained as an interfaith minister, and my teacher asked me to create such a training for the UK, which is where I was living for a number of years. And so I did that, and so I had 10 years as a spiritual director training and ordaining others to become spiritual directors, counselors, and ministers, something that had never happened in the UK before. There were no non-traditional seminaries then. And, so I've always been a bit of a trailblazer and have found myself by necessity, really, you know, diving into these deep waters, having powerful, not always easy experiences, and then for years afterwards sort of unpacking that and seeing what was that really and how does it translate to benefiting others and bringing forth transformation and understanding and wisdom that can be used. And so a big turning point in my own awakening path happened in 2005 when I was meditating in the cave that had been the home of Sri Ramana Maharshi, that I'm sure many of your listeners know. And this really marked the non-dual turning for me, where my experience of, you know, my own nature and of God, you know, opened from, you know, boundless love and fullness to absolute non-conceptual nothing, no one, no self. So this was very profound and a very big opening and took many years to integrate. And I've spoken quite at length in other interviews about the realization into non-doing, non-being, being nothing, being no one, allowing a deconstruction of all my kind of sense of identity and the habits and beliefs and support structures that went with that all started to dissolve.
Well, and I just want to say something to everyone who can't see you, because I can see you, but as you're talking about this no one, no thing, you're just glowing. It's like your smile got really big as you started talking about this. So
yeah, well, it's very funny in that, you know, so many people on the spiritual path are, you know, practicing to kind of fix the seeming problem of me, to become a more spiritualized, perfected version of themselves. And the cosmic joke in it all is that it's not about that. It's really about seeing that what you think you are doesn't even exist. And once you kind of see that, you know, you can see through the veil of trying to be a someone, then all of the story of ego deficiency, which for most people manifests as a felt sense of feeling somehow not good enough or feeling somehow that they're not worthy, and all the searching that goes on to try to deal with that, to get others to mirror us in the way we hope, to get the love, I mean, all that falls away. Once you realize that what you thought you were was a construct, then there's so much more freedom and joy and beauty possible, because there's a deep relaxation that happens, and with it a falling away of the shell, really. And while, you know, the personality, our ego kind of hears, I don't want to be nothing, I want to be something, it's once you actually surrender and just let go of the whole construct of self, then it's amazing the fullness, the beauty, the peace that's naturally here and just starts to shine forth. And it's independent of circumstance and particulars. So this is what happened for me in 2005, and then that opening, you know, really took me apart, deconstructed me, and so much change happened in that time, and then there was the integration that still continues and still is unfolding. And so much of what I'm teaching these days has really come from what I've learned, not just what I've learned in terms of study and 25 years full-time as a teacher working with people internationally, but you know, what I've really learned about not just the process of opening to these deep dimensions of our true nature, but what it takes to actually live them, what it takes to come down from the mountain and really live it in ordinary life, in our relationships, in our marriages, in our ordinary functioning, so that we're more stabilized in the awareness of what we truly are, and more natural and fluid in our responsiveness to life.
All right, I have a question for you. I know that we're going to talk a little bit about something that you call the virtues, right? Mm-hmm. And are these, first, I have two questions that I'll ask at once. First of all, are the virtues something you realize during the integration process? And secondly, if so, you, of course, had had at least a couple of awakenings before you started to live these virtues. Is it helpful for someone to live these virtues to the best of their ability, even if they've had no awakening experiences?
Well, I need to kind of, in order to respond to your questions, because those are important questions, I need to say a bit more about it, in that it's not as black and white, like before and after. So when I say the virtues, it's actually a body of teachings that I call the pillars of awakening. So I'm quite a visual person, and what I noticed is that the primary practice of self-realization that I share is self-inquiry. And yet, self-inquiry classically has been practiced in a very transcendent way. If you look at Advaita, you know, the primary question or the primary practice is to hold firm to the I am, to the unchanging awareness, and to bring everything back to that foundational spiritual question, who am I? However, what I found is that, you know, for Westerners in particular, who live much more complex lives, who are living in a culture where the personal self is so much more developed. In the East, it's a very collectivist culture. And so matters of the personal aren't so important, culturally speaking. And so those traditions work fairly well in those cultures. And I find that there's big gaps when we take traditions that from one culture and just try and transpose them on another. So what I found was, you know, guiding people into direct experience of their true nature through self-inquiry. What I started to see in those years coming back from India after that huge awakening was that, to me, it was very simple. You see, you just have to turn into your direct experience. Whether your direct experience is seemingly an egoic experience of anger or fear or doubt, or whether your experience is of bliss or beauty, the practice of self-inquiry really asks you to meet everything and to not manipulate your experience, to not try and get anywhere particular, to meet everything and allow the truth to unfold itself. So it's not about trying to get to a particular state. Self-inquiry really is about contacting the truth through diving into what's so. So in my method of holistic self-inquiry, we inquire with everything that arises, and we meet first the content of your experience, whether that's emotions, feelings, thoughts, you know, shock, hurt, you know, joy, bliss, and we meet it with your senses. We open your heart towards it. We open to really meet in the depths of things, what is this? So when we meet the content of your experience and you do nothing to fix or change it, don't manipulate in any way, there's a purification and a realization that starts happening all of itself. That, from where I could sit, was very simple, very profound. And so I would hold satsang, inviting people to just come sit with me and meet whatever they wanted to meet that was here and see what really is there. And so when you meet the content of your experience all the way without any commentary or rejection of it, the what actually transmutes, purifies into the who, because the one who is experiencing all of this is the same self, it's really God. So you can easily come to experience this. But what I found was most people just could not drop into their experience in the West. They just couldn't. Was so caught up in patterns of mind, projecting their experience, trying to get to some idealized spiritual experience, trying to get into what they think of as a spiritual state, trying to imitate their spiritual heroes. I mean, endless forms of manipulation that obstruct what Ramana spoke of as the perennial method, which is to be still. So what I find is that Westerners have such trouble actually being still. There's constant manipulation going on. And so what I found was, started to get curious, why is it that people can't so easily just sort of drop in and meet their experience and open, surrender through it? And I saw that there was usually gaps in their holding container, but usually related to a lot of their history. So I started to track this, like, what's really needed to be present and undefended and, you know, to really meet everything and surrender into it. And I saw that trust is needed. Without sufficient trust, we can't surrender, we can't be still, we can't open. And so I also saw that not just trust conceptually, but, you know, body memory, trust in our heart. And you see, trust is something I had been working on with for years. I was already well aware how important trust is for spiritual awakening of any kind. And so it wasn't a before and after thing in the way you phrased the question. So in my previous teachings, when I was director of the Free Interfaith Seminary, when I was teaching A Course in Miracles, this large part of, you know, what I was teaching, it was all about helping people to open to felt experience of divine love. And you see, when you experience divine love, then trust comes very easily. And trust makes us courageous. And so trust is such an important virtue. But a lot of what kind of inhibits our capacity to trust is, you know, traumas from our early childhood that are usually pre-verbal. They have to do with our mothering, the way we were held or not held and attuned to. And so much of it isn't just conceptual. It's coming from the subconscious and the consciousness of the body. And so a lot of, in order to develop the virtue of trust, there's usually quite a lot of inner development and inquiry and spiritual practices that need to flesh that out. So I saw that similarly, some people's kind of weaknesses had to do with a weakness in their love of the truth. And so we see that not only are all egos inherently fearful, mistrusting, all egos inherently have self-deception in them. And so that's why love of the truth is such an important virtue to qualify, to develop. And so, you know, love of the truth is really the synthesis of bhakti and jnana yoga, right? So for inquiry to work at all, we have to love the truth more than we love being comfortable, more than we want to hold on to any attachment, more than we love any self-image. And so that's quite a development in and of itself, to get that real with yourself and to develop a love affair with the real, right, ongoingly. And so I have a whole body of teachings that's about cutting through self-deception and really learning to cherish and relish the truth for its own sake. And so this can deepen and open, and when it opens fully, it becomes absolute devotion. Not devotion to a deity or a teacher, but devotion to truth itself. And so we need also the third virtue, which is curiosity. So curiosity is necessary to handle the egoic tendency of opinions and fixed positions, closed-mindedness. And again, I've been working with this, you know, with the Course in Miracles. One of the important virtues of the teachers of God, it says, is open-mindedness. But curiosity is more than just open-mindedness. It's open-heartedness. And it's kind of a learning to use the body and our sensate awareness to sense into truth, to sense into our direct experience. And when we include, you know, curiosity in the body and the heart and the mind, then there's tremendous expansiveness that, and delight and excitement that switches on in our consciousness, where we can really surf deeper dimensions with a lot more capacity. And then we also need the virtue of non-attack, which is really about learning to disengage from inner violence, the inner violence of judgment and self-hatred that in psychotherapeutic circles has been talked of as the superego. And I love what Ramana Maharshi said about this. He said that they talked about the superego as the thief dressed as the policeman here to guard the treasure. And so much of the chitch that people, the judgments, the opinions, the commentation, oh, I should be like this, this state isn't right, I should be, it's just inner violence ultimately. And it creates like the static of a bad radio station that's going on in your mind that has a very kind of contracting effect on your consciousness. One of my students recently described the feeling of her superego as a bit like wearing a swimming cap that was way too tight, right? And so it was so brilliant that she could feel this because that's the effect of the attack thoughts, the superego, the inner judgment. It has a contracting effect, and because the job of the superego is to protect your central ego identity. And so unless we can really see the self-attack for what it is, whether it takes the form of envy or doubt or projecting our judgment or internalizing our judgment or commentating, it's still self-attack. And it will have a very limiting effect on your capacity to know who and what you are and know the reality, expand. Because to really deepen through self-inquiry requires for you to be willing to be undefended. So those of you who are Course in Miracles students will have been introduced to that important teaching on how the power of defenselessness, right? But you see, to be undefended and present and to meet everything with openness and curiosity to really see what truth is, there needs to be, you know, safety. There needs to be a compassionate inner atmosphere where it's okay to just see whatever's there, right? So, you know, for so many people, they need so much help with just dealing with the superego, just learning to relax the self-attack. And so there's a whole body of teachings and practices I've developed that help with that. So then the fourth of the virtue of the pillars of awakening is humility. And so humility helps us to deal with the often pernicious ego tendency of arrogance. So all egos, whether we're aware of being an arrogant personality type or not, have arrogance in them. And what I mean by that is that we think we created ourselves. We often live and act as if, you know, we are the captain of our own ship and that, you know, this is our life and we should be able to do with it what we like. And that's a complete denial of the fact that all of us were birthed into being by a mystery so profound and vast. And, you know, that our life is really a gift. It belongs to grace. And humility helps us to wake up to the mystery and to bow into the mystery. And it helps us to, you know, really let go of our control and our demands and to open into the space of unknowing. So this is incredibly important if we want to deepen beyond, you know, the conceptual sense of who am I and how do I live a real life? It requires the kind of humility of, you know, opening into the unknown space again and again and again and again and again. So it requires us to really have that humble attitude and not rest on our laurels. But we also need the willingness, and we need the willingness to engage our decision to, you know, to really kind of turn into the true desire for, you know, the real, for walking the path substantially, Because often what arises is, you know, so much external orientation. By that I mean, you know, we're often lured by so many shiny objects in this world. You know, lured by, you know, the promises of, you know, we'll just get a bit of happiness if we wear the right clothes, or, you know, we'll just finally get that kind of egoic desire met if we be a little fake here or there and not quite tell the truth. You know, and that's so pervasive, so hypnotic in our world, and especially in the West, where we're so bombarded by the messages of the media that are really kind of pumping, you know, it's a big ego sell. You know, get more, become more, and you'll be happy. And, you know, if you've done any study or research of the human condition so far, you will already have seen that there's no end to that. And so willingness helps us to turn again and again towards our practices, towards what we really love and want, and to be steadfast and committed. And so, you know, the last of the virtues is patience. And it was really interesting that it took me up until 2 years ago to see that that virtue needed to be in the whole model of the pillars, because it says a lot about my own blind spot right there. But, you know, in that we can engage our practices and we need to. We can learn to be present. We can be interested and willing to look at everything honestly and see what it is. But we can't make grace come. Grace comes when it comes. And so patience reminds us of this exquisite dance between the appropriate effort and effortlessness on the path. And so ultimately, patience helps us to do our best and recognize we're not in charge, to really let go of the reins, and to really just love where we are and allow everything to be exactly as it is. And so together, these virtues form a true container, and wherever we are, wherever we find ourselves on the path, it's a little bit like this gives us a little map of where to look at ourselves, where to deepen. We'll probably find that one or two pillars are reasonably well developed, and then others of them are very undeveloped, or there's a big kind of weakness. So that's very helpful to see, and to see where we can kind of put our attention in our practice at this point in our life to allow a deepening and a broadening that makes it easier for the foundational practice of surrender, of being still, more possible.
All right. So do you mind just running down the list again in order of what the pillars were?
Trust, love of the truth, curiosity, non-attack, humility, willingness, and patience.
Yay, I got them all.
So also for listeners, you can go to my website, and there's in the section called The Approach, there's that all written out, and I give a lot of body of teachings on different pillars. And in my website and articles, I've written kind of extensive teachings on some of the pillars, particularly on trust, because I find that so many people really need to work on that. And there's a beautiful article, too, on non-attack, but it's titled, You Are Not a Problem to Be Fixed.
There's a question that's written in our sanctuary. It's from Rebecca. Rebecca wants to know if trust and faith have the same meaning to you.
Not quite. So trust is really more the sense of being able to relax, sense of being able to let go into the sense of feeling that there's something holding you, that you don't have to hold yourself. So trust is really comes alive when we feel the loving goodness whether we label that God or just the love of the universe or just that, you know, that we can let go. And faith relates more to where we place our trust and our faith. So in a way, we can tend to place our faith in all kinds of things. We can, usually the word faith usually, you know, is used in relation to a particular belief or a particular stream of teaching. But trust is a bit more visceral, less conceptual.
So for example, then I could have faith in a good job will keep me safe. Mm-hmm. That would be an example of faith. And it might actually come from, that faith might come from a weakness in trust.
It might.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have to take a deeper dive into that
yeah.
to really
yeah.
see. Yeah. I like the word trust, though, because, you know, sometimes the word faith is sort of hooked up with religious traditions in a particular way that, you know, brings up. It takes people in a different direction that they have to believe, for example, in Jesus Christ as their personal savior. And, well, if that's not real for you, you can't trust in that, can you? It's not real. And so often that gets people into a bit of a loop. So I like to use the languaging of trust and emphasize that because sometimes it does come from a felt sense of a connection to an enlightened being. And sometimes, you know, the trust comes forth in various dimensions. So there's trusting in the underlying goodness of reality. There's trusting in your own true nature to find its way. And there's trusting in the process to unfold optimally. And so trust can, you know, allow for all of the levels, interpersonal, kind of interior, and, you know, cosmological simultaneously.
And so what would be a symptom that would show a person that maybe their trust needs to be developed?
Well, anxiety, for one, it's pretty obvious. And hypervigilance, when we're trying to work out too much with our mind and strategize, do I do this, do I do this? You know, a lot of the mental activity is indicative that there's not much trust. And a lot of just tension in the body, like a kind of a holding oneself and a lot of tension. Usually, whenever there's not a natural sort of relaxation down into oneself, into the belly, and usually what comes with that is hyperactivity of the mind to try to compensate, that's indicative that there's not much trust.
And I know that you have a whole body of teachings around these things, but can you give us an example of what someone might do if they realize they need to develop trust?
Yeah. Well, I've written about it extensively in two articles, Cultivating Trust and another article called Limitless Holding. So I'm directing people there because that would be, you know, more extensive. But there's several things. Firstly, what needs to happen is the mistrust needs to be brought to the light of awareness, seen and understood and met. You can't just sort of try and strengthen your trust without flushing up and out the mistrust. So one of the ways that I invite people to do that is to, you know, dive into inquiry with a repeating question, what limits my capacity to trust? And, you know, so it's really good to set a timer for, say, 20 minutes and to journey into that question and to let the question enter your body and to see what your body responds with the question, like stress, patterns of tension, holding, you know, what, there might be emotions. There might be memories, there might be sort of fears and concerns. And, you know, once you kind of let that come up, typically when I give people inquiry questions, I create very specific sequences of questions, like what limits your capacity to trust. And well, you can also inquire, who does that belong to? You know, you can inquire into the identity of the one who's mistrusting. You might find that it's historically based. You might find it's ancestral, that you kind of inherited a certain way of being that had mistrust in it from your mother or your father. You might have found that it was a cultural overlay or might belong to your gender. And when you really start inquiring, And is that not just looking into the content, but into the source of that content, then it starts to really flush itself out. And the big key is when you see something about the mistrust, you don't have to do anything about it. This is really key, is that just meeting, you know, the habits of closure, the history, the hurt, the reasoning, the fear, you know, it just needs to be met by contacted with unconditional awareness. You don't have to then go on a search to try and fix this problem of mistrust. You just need to contact the mistrust and let it breathe. So when I'm working, guiding people to do this in retreat, we'll have them working in pairs with one partner asking the question and letting the other respond, and just anything they say, thank you. No commentary, no, oh yeah, me too, or oh wow, you really sound like an Enneagram type 6, let me give you what I found that was helpful. All of that completely interferes with another's process and keeps things on the conceptual level. So you use these kinds of questions to just dive and let it all come out and let it all be met and just stay in your body by whatever means necessary and breathe. And so that's usually a process and usually brings up a lot of, you know, very vulnerable material, which is good, needs to happen, it needs to be contacted and liberated. And so once we've let some of that come to light, we can inquire with, you know, the question like, what's holding you now? So when trust comes online directly, it feels like being completely held by the whole universe, as if you are in the arms of the Divine Mother and inseparable from that. And so it's really good to also inquire into your direct experience of holding in this moment. And sometimes people say, nothing's holding me, I'm all alone. That's how it feels when you're really identified with separation. But if you really honestly come to the question, then, you know, you might be able to feel that there's a chair holding your body. If you draw your attention into what's holding you now, you might notice that the oxygen is holding you, that you're drawing breath, and that you don't have to make oxygen happen, it's just here, and it's giving you nourishment and life, it's holding you. You might notice that my voice has an effect of holding you right now, bringing into your awareness the remembrance of the love that you're naturally in and part of, and who knows? So that's an inquiry I often say to people, go on a walking meditation and just stay with that question. And walk in nature and stay with that question. Stay with it. So I also give this as a meditation. So on my website, there's an audio meditation on cultivating trust. And this is also a big part of why I teach mantra. So there's a lot of devotional work in my approach to awakening. And so mantra is a way of transmitting various states through the Sanskrit syllables. And it kind of has a back door, comes in on the back door of our consciousness. And so because the felt sense of trust has so much to do with the boundless love, then there are certain mantras that help bring that forth. To sing those mantras can be very healing and helpful. That's why I recorded an album called The Heart of Being. It has a lot of those mantras in it. And there's another album on its way that'll be next year.
All right. So,
I could give more, but I hope that's sufficient.
Well, it's a good taste, which I think, you know, in 90 minutes, that's really what we're looking for is a taste. We know you can't give everything in such a short time, but we're here to get a good feel for you and your teachings so people can discover if there's more interest.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, do you have a feel for where we should go next?
Well, I could go in a lot of different directions, so how about you lead and I'll just follow the thread of what you feel will be most valuable to your listeners.
Well, let me see if they have a question. Let me pop over and, okay, I have a question here. We have a couple of questions. One, Miranda said in the beginning that true non-dualism doesn't deal with the things around getting a better life for the self, for the ego, Please tell me more about that. That is from Igor.
Okay. So, you know, true non-duality, let's just quantify that for a moment. Non-duality is the kind of hot, trendy word in spiritual teaching right now, which is interesting to me as I've been around long enough to see trends coming and going. But if we really look at what non-dual means, it means not two. And so really what non-dual teachings are about is about helping you to really realize the unity that is, you know, the absolute depth of your being. And when you understand, not just in conceptually, but when you really experience the depth of what you are as part of the totality of everything that is, then there's not so much of a need to try to kind of bolster and puff up the construct of me, because the construct of me, if you look at that, is usually kind of a little one who feels cut off from the supply, who's trying to kind of, you know, get what it needs from all sorts of external sources. And so much of the stress and the suffering of our human condition is wrapped up in that. And so bottom line is, the more you relax down into the foundation of what you really are, the more you recognize that the love, the peace, the freedom, the fulfillment, the meaning, the acceptance, you know, the beautiful qualities that you've so often been seeking for in particular circumstances are already part of your own nature. They're part of the fragrance of your own being. And so, you know, once you kind of rest in that depth of yourself, then so much of the unnecessary suffering and striving falls away. And you can just be. And so this is really quintessential to the lineage of Ramana Maharshi, really, who said, you know, that everything was just be as you are. It's not be as you think you are. It's not be as you think you should be. It's not try and be like Ramana. It's be as you are. And so that invites a certain kind of relaxation into your own direct experience just here and now. That is both very simple, radically simple, and yet profoundly direct and immediate. That what usually is the hardest hurdle is giving up the hope that some kind of strategy is going to get you what you think you don't have. So an inquiry that I'm often giving to my long-time student, every now and again I throw this one at them, like, tell me an ego strategy you still hope one day will work. And, you know, we tend to think of as hope as a really important spiritual virtue, but it actually was the last thing to come out of Pandora's box, hope. The ego's full of hope. But if we just get things tweaked in the right direction, just lose the weight, just get the right partner, just learn the latest spiritual lingo, you know, then we'll be able to relax. Well, what I'm saying is, why not relax here and now and see what happens?
Thank you.
So for those of you who are A Course in Miracles students, you know, what's really ironic is, you know, the Course in Miracles is saying this too. I mean, clearly I was a slow learner because I had been reading for 15 years prior to sitting in Ramana's cave, you need do nothing. And I remember in my early 20s, I was working through the workbook lessons, and I remember that lesson that said, the light has come. And I thought, and then another lesson, like, there is nothing to fear. And the descriptions for these lessons were so straightforward and simple, and I so didn't get it. I remember going right back to the beginning of the workbook thinking I must have missed something, because it so was not my experience that the light has come and that there's nothing to fear. That was so not my experience at all. So I thought, I'm not getting something here. I don't understand this. And yet, of course, once you wake up to realize there is literally nothing to fear, literally, Right? Because what you fear is when you look directly into your fear, you see that not only is it nothing, it belongs to someone who doesn't actually even exist. Right? And then the whole constellation of fear disappears. So it's true, there is nothing to fear. And, you know, and of course when you realize that, the light actually has come because it's always been here and you're in it and part of it. And that's the non-dual level. Right?
Yes.
That the non-dual awakening brings that experience, like, into your midst. It's not a change, it's a recognition.
All right, I have another question, but I think before I ask it, I want to ask you, well, my question already flew out, so we'll go to Dolores' question. Dolores is asking, do you believe in spontaneous realization?
Absolutely. Yeah, of course. And pretty much all realization is spontaneous realization. But in a way, there's this beautiful dance between spiritual practice and the spontaneous realization. So one of the things that I really love to do, and I really recommend that you guys do it too, is really read the biographies of these great beings. And when you read them and you read beyond the kind of glorified propaganda of they were a saint from the beginning and all of that, when you really read the backdrop, you'll see that there was usually some backdrop of serious inquiry or some kind of deep practice. And even in people who, for example, Ramana Maharshi, who woke up when he was 16, you know, there must have been some really intense, deep spiritual development in other lifetimes for him to be able to hold his breath for as long as it takes to go into rigor mortis in order to realize that you're not the body.
Yeah, and yes,
you and I both know, I'm sure we've all, as children, played the game of how long can you hold your breath, and that survival instinct is pretty darn strong. So to be able to hold your breath for long enough to actually go through the death experience, which is what happened to him, that shows immense, total love of the truth and willingness, right, and trust, all of the virtues that I've gone through. You can see, for a person to be able to do that, that's some serious kind of development in his consciousness.
Well, yeah, and you could also say, you know, I mean, obviously when we say maybe prior lives, we don't really know, we're guessing. But the amount of practice that occurred in those minutes was intense, intense practice. So what we can't really say is that he awoke without practice.
Right, exactly. And so this is always a conversation that I have interesting debates with students. You know, as many people in non-dual circles think that, well, people who get awake spontaneously and therefore practice has nothing to do with it. But I don't think that's the truth. And there's a beautiful Zen saying that, you know, enlightenment is a divine accident and spiritual practice makes one more accident prone. And I love that. And I also love what Ramana himself said, which is that there is a state beyond both effort and effortlessness. But he said, until that state is realized, the gentle effort is required. And he also said that one's dedication to awakening needs to be equal a person whose head is being held underwater wants to rise to the surface to draw breath. And so that's powerful, like willingness, dedication, love of the truth. It's the more these virtues are developed, the easier, you know, when those moments come, we can just let it happen. And so I look at my own experience too, and I doubt very much that day I happened to sit in Ramana Maharshi's cave and I didn't have any agenda. I wasn't trying to get anywhere. I was just happy to sit and meditate in the cave that belonged to a great being. And for whatever reason, by some grace, you know, things opened up that day. But I doubt whether that would have opened and whether I would have been able to integrate that realization without all those years prior of study and teaching. And I certainly wouldn't have been able to integrate it very well without study and teaching and inquiry and sitting with others and, you know, digesting the experience. And so I think it's really important that if you want to have the occasional spiritual experience, then go right ahead. You know, practice might not be necessary. But if you want to live an awakened life, then practice wants to become your good friend.
Okay, I'd like to talk more about that if you don't mind. You've mentioned the word integrate a few times. I'm not certain everybody really knows what that means. And I love what you just said. If you want to have an occasional experience, go ahead. But if you want to live an awakened life, so why don't we talk a little bit about the difference between spiritual experiences mm-hmm. and living an awakening life, and talk a little bit about what integration is.
Sure. Well, you know, spiritual experiences where we're opened to taste directly, you know, the more subtle, deep dimensions of what we are and what reality is, whether what we taste is the reality of boundless love or whether we taste no self, whether we taste infinite emptiness, whether we taste, you know, kind of deep bliss, whether we taste, you know, equanimity independent of circumstance. And so these are things that I'm naming are all different ways that grace, in a way, the direct experience of divine nature can show up. And don't limit what I haven't said, because there's so many. I mean, literally the word boundless is used in, particularly by the Tibetans, and I use the word a lot too, for very good reason, because the depth of God and of what we are is not bounded by any concept. And so there's always more to discover about what we are, what God is, and how therefore to live. And so it's not just about, okay, I've had this experience, great. Well, you know, my own experience is that God wants to be known endlessly, freshly, in all sorts of new ways. And so my own experience of awakening is it's becoming richer and more dimensional and more total. And also that it wants to be lived in every single moment. Whether I'm at the sink washing dishes, you know, am I present to, you know, the substance of the water? Am I in my body? Am I awake in that moment to the privilege of this life? And as I'm drawing breath, am I awake to the grace of existence and the nourishment of the life-giving oxygen that's such a gift from all the plant life, right? Mm-hmm. As I'm sitting with a friend, am I awake to the living, breathing embodiment of God that she or he is? As I'm making love with my husband, is there the awareness that this too is God, that this energy, this being, this responsiveness is God? Is there, as I'm sitting doing my email, am I present? Is there just a fluid, kind of appropriate, elegant responsiveness in the way I function in ordinary communication? Mm-hmm. And so when I say not just having an occasional sort of spiritual orgasm, but living an awakened life, I'm talking about every single moment living awake. And so a lot of that comes down to learning how to be present, learning how to be in touch with our own direct experience, learning to really listen to the pulse of knowing that arises in body, heart, and mind moment to moment, and being fluid with that, and being wise and discriminating. And all of that happens very naturally the deeper and more embodied we are in our realization.
All right. So, go ahead.
And this also includes the levels of our being. So the deeper understanding of non-duality means that, you know, nothing is two. And that means that the relative aspect of our human experience, body and heart and personality, you know, is ultimately an arising of the same absolute pure consciousness. And so often I see so much splitting happening in the name of spiritual awakening, and people kind of saying, oh, that's just my ego, and just sort of dismissing it and trying to get rid of it. And that so easily becomes just aggression upon the self, and annihilation of the relative aspect. And so when we really get it, that everything is God, then even though, you know, there might be kind of personality structures in us that are still haven't been seen through, that we're still attached to or caught by, ultimately the ground of it is still God. And so, you know, that all wants to be integrated. And I find that commonly too many people just want to jump over doing their psychological work, and it doesn't work. That's where you get unglued, because what isn't understood very well is that the deeper you drop into these boundless spiritual dimensions, the more it pushes on any of your observations. And so you usually have to kind of be more thorough with, you know, looking at your shadow material more rather than less.
Yes.
And, yeah. And why humility is so important too.
All right. There's a couple things that you've said that I would like to talk about. One, you talked about listen to the pulse of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say, using Course in Miracles language, that's the same as listening to the Holy Spirit?
Yes, I would. Only in Course in Miracles languaging, listening to the Holy Spirit, people often expect to hear a voice. And some people do. Some people, you know, have kind of easy access to that kind of auditory dominance. But really, if you broaden out what the Holy Spirit is really the spirit of wholeness, the spirit of knowing, that which knows and remembers the truth of things. And so we can listen with our whole being. We can listen with our senses. We can listen, with our heart. I have a whole body of teaching on guidance. You know, it's part of the body of teaching I call Your Soul Knows the Way. And not only do we need to listen and learn to listen with our whole being, but to also have some sensible, you know, gates of discrimination, because it's very, very easy to delude ourselves in this whole subject of guidance and think, oh, the Holy Spirit told me, when it might be a little bit that, but it might also be very distorted with, you know, things that, you know, aren't quite awakened yet. We've seen a lot of that. We've seen a lot of awful things being acted in the world because, you know, God told me so. So it's very important to have some gates of discrimination around guidance.
Yeah, in fact, ISIS right now is following their guidance as they perceive it, right?
That's right, exactly. And they think that by doing this, they're going to, you know, go to heaven and, you know, have all these beautiful brides waiting for them, and, you know, that what they're doing is noble. And according to God's will, that's the belief.
Is there anything that you can share that will help people who want to be self-honest discern between what I'm going to call pure guidance and then maybe something that's a little more distorted by ego?
Right. So firstly, when we understand about pure guidance is really coming from the depth of being, because purity is unified. The mind of God is unified mind. And so, therefore, guidance, if it's true, will have the fruit of certainly not harming anyone. Because the consciousness of pure of truth is about what's good for all, not just about what's good for one over another. So there'll be a sense of it being non-harming and good for all in some way. It will always come with a tone of love and peace for all. If there's any uncertainty about it, it can usually be confirmed. So usually if one goes into prayer and says, I'm not sure, you know, help me to know whether this is true or not true, then usually we happen upon some scripture or something we read about in the book or a conversation with someone, and these often the exact words are said. So those are the three things that I would always look out for if we're not sure. And another thing that one can do, which Helen Schuckman did so beautifully with Bill Thetford, is write it down and have a friend you trust look at it. You know, check it out.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, again, if you guys have questions, please type them in the room. If I miss them, just retype them. Or, of course, as you know, you can put up your hand and I will turn the mic over to you. We have about half an hour left. And so if you have questions, it's really time to start getting into those questions, because pretty soon Miranda will be gone, at least for tonight. So I have a question. I'm wondering if you have a story to tell, a story which is kind of like a picture in the book that will help demonstrate. You mentioned earlier about how, you know, even after some awakenings, even after some integration, there may still be some ego constructs that you haven't looked at yet that are showing up. I wonder if you have a story of discovering something like that, seeing a blind spot of yours, and what that experience was like for you.
Yeah, sure. Well, yeah, I mean, certainly in terms of my own personality structure, fear hasn't been the biggest issue for me. I think I came in with a lot of courage naturally, and I can't really lay personal credit to that. I think it's just a development that I came in with from former lives. But control has been a more difficult one for me personally to really unhook from. And so this was in a time, you know, a couple of years after the awakening in the cave, and I'd already, you know, gone through this big deconstruction, and I already realized the delight that I'm nothing and no one, and that that's not a problem, that's actually freedom. But still this kind of tendency of control would arise every now and again. So one day I was inquiring into this with a friend, and I was practicing and wanting to really journey in to see a bit more about this. And so this is part of what I mean about holistic self-inquiry. It's not necessarily conceptual. I was kind of just diving in and surfing the inner terrain and, you know, really kind of really wanting with my heart prayerfully to sort of see more, understand more about this structure of control. So what came up as I was diving in is that all of a sudden there's this image of a great big cleat. A cleat, those of you who don't know, is a great big steel hook that hooks the boat, you know, onto the shore, you know, with a rope. So there's this image that emerged inside of me of this big, honking, rusty metal cleat. And so I felt into this sense of the cleat, like, with the spirit of inquiry, like, what's this really? And sort of emerging, I saw this boat and then this great big, craggy captain. It was almost comical, you know. And so in the same way, you know, with sort of journeying through inquiry where everything is an aspect of yourself, I'm exploring, you know, this steel, rusty cleat, you know, that hooks, you know, the boat to the shore, you know, and the captain is part of myself. And I realize this captain is kind of rugged and crude and very unrefined, you know. And it was kind of saying, this ship belongs to me. This is my ship. I am the captain of this ship. And I burst out laughing because it was really clear that that was the structure of control. You know, this is me. This is my life. This is the way I want it to go. There's a lot of kind of my will in there. Yes. And it was kind of had a very masculine, phallic kind of tough quality to it. So I was meeting this and I realized, oh gosh, this feels like my father, you know. So I could also feel the lineage of where this had arisen from in my personality, and that was very much how I experienced my dad. And, you know, he seemed to be pretty powerful when I was a little kid. And so it was really good, all these insights and seeing this structure that was partly inherited, partly, you know, a personality fixation that was stronger than other ones. And so as I kind of was just meeting all of this, as it happens in inquiry, so when you really meet things without any judgment, you meet like inner structures like that, consciousness, and you see them for what they are. When there's no should or shouldn't, no conversation about it, you're just meeting it. You meet it and it starts to just dissolve all of itself. And so pretty soon in this inquiry, you know, the sense of the cleat disappeared, the sense of the captain disappeared, the sense of there being a boat just started to sail into this black, infinite sea, and then the boat disappeared, and then the sea disappeared. And then there I was, just in that, nothing, no one. And so it was a deeper integration of no thing, no self, you know, no boundary. Right? So that was an example of a deeper integration, one of many, around a structure that kept reasserting itself, which was around control. And how, you know, sometimes we need to go a little deeper with these things that show up, and then they start dissolving and refining and transmuting. And so it was interesting that after that, there was a whole other level of stabilization, that I found myself just functioning naturally, you know, in a more unwavering place, that not taking myself very seriously and yet being very stable, present, open, able to just sort of be here in an ordinary way and yet feeling, you know, very boundless simultaneously.
Well, and one thing that I love about you in my week of getting to know you, one thing that I love about you is, I'm going to say it's the soft side of that control. It is focus down to business. This is what we're here for, you know. So, you know, you're able to really present yourself in a very clear way. You don't get distracted and run off in all directions. And I can see how the control and this focus, this down to business, this clarity are somehow related, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing to say. I think, you know, what I learned about control is it's usually an issue of will, right? Because it's control is ego will, personal will, trying to kind of, you know, maintain dominance, trying to be in charge. And, you know, so when the kind of the personal will lets go a little bit, there's often the clarity and the focus that was developed through the control.
Yes.
It's liberated. And so what's left is, you know, that focus and that clarity and that strength, but without the kind of pushing and pulling going on.
Yes, and you also
that's experience too.
Yeah, and you also have a nice structure about you. You know, I mean, I haven't had the opportunity yet to witness a retreat with you. I hope to at some point. But my previous job, I was a corporate trainer. So I know how to recognize a good trainer. It's my job, my old job. And I see the structure, and even just the little bit I hear from you, I know that it's all put together in a very good way. And again, I think all of that is probably very related. Like I said, the softer side. Once the self-will was let go.
Yeah, well, it's also just experience. I've been doing this a ridiculously long time. You know, it's crazy, really, but, you know, I was ordained when I was 25 and asked by my teacher to set up the Interfaith Seminary when I was 26. And so I was kind of thrown into teaching, you know, very early, and had to learn a lot, not just about, you know, how to talk about, you know, beautiful spiritual truth, but my passion is about guiding people into really come to know and live this themselves, because me talking about my realization is, I hope, inspirational and meaningful, but ultimately you need to taste it yourself, and my passion is for that to happen. So I'm always interested in, you know, how can this come alive in another human being? How can they taste this for themselves? And not only taste it, but, you know, digest the wisdom of the taste, so that it becomes real and lived. And so that kind of curiosity and passion in me translates into a lot of listening. Like, my preparation for teaching is, I go into meditation, I let go into meditation, I ask, you know, what's needed, and I start getting a download about a stream of understanding, and then I always pray, how do we let this come alive for them? And so that's where I'm listening and crafting these sequences of questions and exercises and practices, and I'm listening to what's needed and how people are responding, because I've been teaching pretty much full time for coming up on 25 years, I've just had a lot of experience and passionate about, you know, what can I do that helps point people in the right direction.
Yeah, and you do a very good job. I have a couple more questions. One is from Gloria. Quieting the mind seems to be quite helpful in stepping into the level of trust you talked about in virtue. Okay. What methods do you use or suggest when temporary appearances seem bigger than truth?
Well, there's a lot of different approaches to meditation that I teach people. And it depends entirely on what we're focusing on and what people's strengths and weaknesses are, what meditation works best for them. But one of the things that I have found over the last 5 years in particular is that learning to ground into one's body is about the most direct and powerful and simple method of getting out of the mind. And many meditation methods work more top-down. So I teach to pretty much everybody a meditation practice that people can go onto my website. They go into the sanctuary and onto audio meditations. They'll see a meditation called the Mountain of Presence. And this is a really powerful grounding meditation that helps to open up and develop the lower belly, or what in Taoism is called the Dan Tien Center. And most people's minds are overactive because their Dan Tien or belly center is very weak. And this is partly a phenomenon because of our culture and the way we live. We have very overdeveloped egoically based head centers and very weak belly centers. And so what that results in is the heart not having a lot of support. So we tend to get caught in our emotions too much and trying to work everything out with our mind. And so if we really want to deepen, that has to quiet down. So the easiest thing is just to come down into your body, to sense the feet on the ground, to take in the holding of the earth, to feel the breath coming in and letting go, and give that your focus for a few minutes, and you'll notice that, you know, the whirring of the mind usually quiets down a little. I also teach practices that help us to open to the stream of grace. It's an adapted form of centering prayer. And again, my website is meditation, graceful surrender, and centering prayer that help people with that. And then there's all kinds of other meditations. But ultimately, all of these methods of meditations are ultimately concentration practices. And concentration is the prelude to meditation. We have to kind of collect our focus. And once the focus of our attention is reasonably kind of settled, then you need to let go of any method and just to rest, just to be still. But for many people, they need years of a concentration practice before that's possible. So it depends where people are.
All right, thank you. Can you give one example of a concentration practice?
Yeah, the Mountain of Presence.
Okay.
For example, if right now you just take a couple of breaths, and on the exhale in particular, just feel as if you're melting in and down. Just like ice will naturally melt in the warmth of the sun. Just feel the mental focus relaxing. You're being drawn down in the sand. Recognizing and feeling the holding of the chair and the floor. And just take in the fact of that holding. But it's not a concept, it's an actual direct experience. And that the earth is an actual, palpable holding. That you can physically feel under your feet right now. It doesn't have an opinion about you. It just is. And so as you settle and feel that, just contemplate even where this earth has come from. We know that there are minerals and rocks, waters under the earth's crust. But when we consider the cause of all of that, we can recognize that there's an immense presence that's infinitely powerful and mysterious and yet ever present. And that we are in it already. And so it's as if we're sitting within a mountain of infinite, boundless, immense presence. And so you can just consider the possibility that your lower body is part of this infinite mountain that has no circumference. That you're grounded in that deep ground of being itself. As if the tip of that mountain lives right down in your deep lower belly. And as the breath rises and falls, just feel the focus of the breath in that tip of the mountain in your belly. And as the breath rises and falls, keep the focus there. So that everything can settle down into the quiet. Mind can drop into the heart. Heart can drop down into this deep belly, that immense port. And you can just rest, infinitely supported and grounded in the presence, right here and now.
I feel like saying amen.
Right.
Thank you. We do have at least another question. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I need to scroll up to it. This is from Igor again. And he says, what does A Course in Miracles say to do about the world and the characters in the dream? And you know what that also reminds me of? We had mentioned that we might talk a little bit about level confusion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Course in Miracles is all about forgiving the characters in the dream. And that's the transformational methodology that it's using. And it's really helping us to deal with the primary mechanism of our ego that is about projection. And so Course in Miracles shares very beautifully how we're always wanting to project the bad out there. And it's a way of trying to offset our kind of experience that the bad is in, there's something bad about us. And so Course in Miracles is primarily asking us to, you know, look beyond that perception by asking the Holy Spirit of the Presence of Holiness to help us see through that appearance and forgive really our own misperception of others and see them as they really are. So that's what A Course in Miracles is saying. I didn't know, what was the second part to that question?
The second part wasn't really Igor's. I was just remembering that when you and I were emailing one another, we had mentioned that we might talk about level confusion.
Sure. All right, so speaking about forgiveness then, you know, level confusion doesn't mean that, you know, that we're stupid, that we're ignorant of where someone's functioning. And so this level of forgiveness that the Course in Miracles is inviting us to doesn't mean that, you know, we be unwise. So it also takes into account that you know, we need to be appropriate. So to forgive, you know, which is really just to let the lens of projection and guilt fall away from our mind, is, you know, to see, to join with another from the depth of our own essence to the depth of theirs. But wisdom, discriminating wisdom, is also being able to take into account, you know, not just who they are, but where they're actually functioning. So, for example, you know, someone who's blowing other people up is, you know, not likely to respond that well to just let me forgive you. That's definitely important, but, you know, Jesus' teaching of don't throw your pearls before swine is applicable here. So Jesus makes this very clear that it's not a value judgment about swine is greater or lesser than any other creature. It's just that they're going to choke on pearls. It's not what they want or need. And so it's really about part of the embodied wisdom that comes when you're more integrated, where we are wise in our actions and wise in our responsiveness. You don't give a child sharp toys or industrial equipment to play with. It's not wise. It doesn't mean the child's bad. It's just that that's not appropriate to them. And they're likely to hurt themselves. So there are people whom it wouldn't be very smart or wise to go and pour your heart out with and tell them the most vulnerable things. They don't want to hear it. They don't know what to do with it. And they might use it in an inappropriate way. So it's really about discrimination.
Yeah, and what I'm hearing is, you know, see clearly without judgment.
Yes. So firstly, you have to deal with the judgment. That's the first step. But it's then about, you know, just the wisdom to just understand that there are different levels of reality happening simultaneously. And that we all know, and I think maybe your listeners can relate to this, like you have an argument with your lover or your partner and you're crazy mad at them over something, right? When you're in it, it's like you're in an altered state. And when you come out of it and you get over it and you come back to kind of a loving place with them, you kind of can think, what's going on with me? How could I have thought that? But at the time, it was so all-encompassing, you couldn't see anything else. And so you have to sort of do that inner part of the work first, of coming out of your misunderstandings, of your fixed perceptions, of the intense judgment and positions. And only when you come out of them is there more objectivity, clarity. And from that, you know, there's more of a natural sense of what to say and do and how.
All right, kind of a related question, again, from Igor. He says, what should I do with my president? I'm from Russia. I hate the Kremlin and Putin, and I don't like that feeling. And then he says, please tell me what to do. So this is probably related to his question earlier about forgiving the characters in the dream.
Well, Ego, I think, is beautiful and brave that, you know, you're even willing to just own that, to really own the fact that you're upset with your president. You know, there are things about him that you feel very upset and frustrated by. And I think the first place is just to be honest about that, which is what I'm hearing from you, and it's beautiful. So I encourage you to just take a look at your own hatred of him and to really see what is it about him that you really can't stand. And does that remind you of anyone else, or is it just about him? And, you know, what is it that you so want to not be there? And what does that trigger within your own heart? So usually hatred arises in us when something is really painful and we feel powerless about it. And so that's why often, you know, we can get so much kind of hate going around our politicians, because often we can feel very powerless to affect a change, and it hurts our heart. But if you then get in touch with that and then open your heart towards the hurt underneath the hatred, that'll likely bring forth some deeper wisdom or compassion or understanding about, you know, where next, what to next. Mm-hmm. And I can't say what that's going to come as, but I trust that as you work with that, that the next level of wisdom will come for you. And I think just encourage you and support you in spirit in that process.
Yeah, and as you're speaking, of course, you're reminding me of your third pillar, which was the curiosity. You know, yes. Being willing to go in with curiosity. What is this
even
all about?
Hatred. Yeah. Even to that. Oh, what is this really? What's it feel like in my body? What happens if I just really need it? What's it really about?
Yeah.
You know, and so that's so loving, fundamentally, to really want to know what is this really. And so that's really what inquiry is about. Inquiry isn't about jumping over anything or trying to get to some, you know, idealized spiritual summit. It's really about contacting your direct experience, wanting to know it truly. What is this really? And not only what is this, but who am I? Who is this one having this experience? What's the true meaning of this? Those questions themselves can take us all the way.
Well, thank you.
I want to close with something that I personally absolutely love. Okay. It's a quote from Lao Tzu. And it really relates to what I've just said about really knowing who and what we are. Lao Tzu said, "If you don't realize the source of your being, you stumble in confusion and sorrow. But when you realize where you come from, you naturally become tolerant, disinterested, amused, kind-hearted as a grandmother, dignified as a king."
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I want to thank you very, very much for saying yes to us.
Yes, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's really a joy. And I will email you tomorrow. For a couple of reasons. One, I will send you the audio, and then two, as you know, we give a gratitude gift for doing this, so I want to talk to you about how you want to receive that gift. But thank you, and
enjoy, and just, you know, for those of you who have been listening, I really hope that something I said has been meaningful and supportive, and very much encourage you to visit my website and have a really good surf around, because there's a lot there. And I also want to mention that one of the real delights for me for the last year is that I'm running online ongoing programs through the Shift Network. And if people sign up to my newsletter, you'll hear about that. But I'm able to now offer a body of teachings and ongoing programs virtually. So that means people wherever they are in the world. And I will have a new program starting with the Shift Network in February. And two others, a whole body of teachings that are being given, downloaded through that. And it's pretty economically doable. So I'm really excited. That means people in Russia, Igor, you could do it, for example. There's no limit to location with that. So I just wanted to let people know that. And if they sign up to my website at www.mirandamcpherson.com, then you'll always receive the information about this from Stephanie.
All right. Thank you very much. That's beautiful.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, Regina.
Thank you. I'll be in touch tomorrow.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.